This is us learning in public, trying to...
Literally learning in public.
Yeah.
We're at Vancouver Public Library. Yes. There are glass doors. Yes. We're literally learning in public.
Pulling back the curtain of silence.
And learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala. This is Seen. Brown-eyed activism.
Healing at the intersections.
This special episode of Scene was recorded at the Vancouver Podcast Festival. The category is sensitivity. Take a listen.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction, and thank you everyone for being here. I wish that I was a less sensitive person so I'd be less nervous.
Same. Same.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I just use humor to, you know,
cover up the
nervousness.
We'll get used to it.
Yeah.
So before I became aware of the way that I was labeled and othered because of my race, my gender, or my sexual orientation, I was intimately aware of a different label that was put on me, something that everyone else seemed to see, but that seemed to make me less than, and that was sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
I was known as a sensitive kid. Were you a sensitive kid?
Yes. My mom used to call Michelle. My sister's here and she's nodding. So yes, I was sensitive. I think it was more like, I don't know. I cried a lot when my mom would like leave for work. I remember that a lot. And I remember my mom also being like, you know, you're sensitive, but you also just like are really brazen and you like say truthful things, but like say it a little bit nicer. So it was like, I was aware of how I felt and I had really big emotions, but also was just like, I'm going to tell you exactly what I see in you all
right.
the time, you know?
So it didn't hold you back.
No.
From that.
Yeah.
At least. Yeah.
How about you? Were you like a big like crier or like what,
oh,
how
yeah.
did you express
yeah,
that?
Yeah. Yeah. I used to cry really, really easily and I could not control it. So school, home, public places, just yeah. like,
aww.
Yeah, a lot of crying, and just not being as, like, rough and tumble maybe as other kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did
Were you,
you
at school known as
Not really. Like, I didn't really, I was a cry, I would say, like, more of a crybaby at home, probably, than I was, like, outside of the house. Outside of the house, like I said, it was more, I was a lot more vocal, but I would notice how other people would treat others around me and how I was treated. Like those things, like perceptive, I think was more what it translated to outside of the home. But inside of the home, it was a lot of like, what's the matter with you is what I would get from my dad. If it was like, you know, you are being moody or you are being too emotional or you're being, or whatever it was, like the sensitivity was definitely something that I should be ashamed of and I should just like move through it. It's not that big of a deal.
Yeah, I definitely feel like I carried that for a long time because people would say I was sensitive, but I could tell that it was like a pejorative.
Oh, yeah.
That's how they meant it.
Yes.
And because I couldn't control it. Yeah, I was at school. Like that's how I was known more publicly, I guess.
Yeah.
So I think last time we were recording, you said you saw me as tough. And I was
yes.
like, oh, this is like healing to my inner child because I feel like really? I've always had something to prove in terms of like, because I think sensitive, when people say sensitive, so often they mean weak.
Yes.
They mean fragile.
Yes.
Like timid, like being a baby, like you
exactly.
said. So it's like this very negative thing. And so, yeah, I've kind of, there's been that like young, wounded part of me that's felt like I have something to prove in terms of like, I'm not weak.
Yeah. Did your family members like allow you to express that sensitivity or was it kind of like, you mentioned not feeling like you were like rough and tumble or that you, you know, did you feel like folks were trying to be protective of you to say like, you know, toughen up basically? Because I feel like parents oftentimes do that because they don't want their kids to go out into the world and just like get shat on by other kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know how much of it was real and how much was in my head, but I definitely felt like my family members were sometimes ashamed of me that I couldn't just, you know, do what other kids could do all the time.
Yeah.
And then I, like you, I definitely, from my dad, he didn't usually respond very well to me crying.
Yeah.
So I definitely got that message of just like, stop crying.
Yeah.
Which I couldn't. And
no.
Then that's the worst. You're
you
like
can't.
Crying and someone's like, stop crying.
That's
and then
like,
you cry
that's
harder.
That's exactly
like,
what Michelle, right? That's what's up. Yeah. That's what happened all the time. No, totally.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting because the way that like sensitivity is like a gendered thing, you know, yes. where it's like sensitive boys. I've seen this because I have some friends that have kids, but also just like witnessing how people parent, watching boys cry and seeing how even like mothers will respond to their sons. Like, don't like, you're fine, it's just toughen up, it's okay. And not allowing their sons, let alone their daughters, to indulge. Like, it's probably, I think it's more acceptable for girls to cry than totally. It is for boys.
Yeah, like I felt looked down upon for crying a lot, but I definitely remember there was a boy in my class in elementary school who was similar, where mm-hmm. he would cry, maybe not quite as much as me, but more easily. Yeah. And I always definitely felt like it was more stigmatized. And I remember thinking too that I was lucky that I was born and understood as a girl, because it would be, I knew that I wouldn't just be able to like man up just because of gender, because I was yeah. so unable to control it. So right. I was just aware of how much worse it was.
Yeah.
I think.
Totally. What is it like, what does being sensitive look like in your adult life? Because I think the way that you express sensitivity when you're a kid is like you can cry and your mom will be, or your parent will hopefully take care of you or attend to you in some way. Like, I know that I still am a crier. Big crier. Nolan's sitting there. He knows. I like, it's funny because it's like, I don't cry with like in front of other people. I'm an Aquarius, so like we don't have emotions. And Sinead, right? What's up? But at the same time, it's like when I'm home in my home space, when I'm comfortable with my family, when I'm with my partner, it's like, that's where I feel free enough to express those sensitivities. And for me, I've noticed that I'll pick up all the things that have happened throughout the entire day or the week or from the news or from social media or whatever, and I'll hold it inside of me, and there'll be certain triggers where I'll just like, it'll all just come out, and it's usually like in me sobbing uncontrollably. Then I like purge that emotion and then I'm like, aww, moving on. I'm wondering if like crying is still a way that you know, express or release that, or have you moved into like, if you're feeling sensitive about something, you're like verbalizing how you feel?
I don't know. It's funny because so when I went through my counseling training, I stopped being so embarrassed about crying, and I cried just like all the time, a lot. I stopped wearing eye makeup. I haven't worn eye makeup since I went to counseling school.
Really?
Yeah, not even waterproof. I'm just like I could cry anytime. Who knows?
Yeah.
But actually, weirdly, once I stopped being so ashamed of it and would just let myself cry if mm-hmm. I started crying, I actually don't need to cry as often. And if I am in a setting where I want to control it, I'm in more control of it. So it's yeah. like, we always talk about how when you suppress something, it like fights back harder.
Yes.
So when I stop suppressing it, that isn't necessarily like an uncontrollable reaction anymore. Yes. I still cry a lot sometimes.
Yeah.
But I think for me, I've just come to understand sensitivity differently. Because I think because crying was so stigmatized, I sort of thought that I kind of conflated the two as being just crying is sensitive
right.
crying,
yes.
you know?
But like, you can cry because you're freaking angry. You can cry. Like, people yeah. always assume like sensitive, soft, weak, but it's like, sometimes you're just got a lot of rage
yeah.
and crying is the way that you express the rage,
yeah.
You know, outside of like smashing things or being like physically like enacting some sort of thing.
Totally.
Out there.
Yeah. And then there's also like a lot of other manifestations of what it is to be sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's still things about being sensitive that I don't love, like I'm physically very sensitive too, so like I don't drink because my body's too sensitive to alcohol, and I wish I could.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
that would make social settings a lot easier for me.
Bearable is what you mean.
Yeah,
as an introvert.
As an introvert, yes, 100%, that's
yeah.
what I mean.
Yeah,
but I also feel like sensitivity is now the key of everything good in my life, mm. from the relationships that I have and how intimate and supportive my relationships are, to my career, being a therapist, doing this podcast. So I think that's really something I want to explore, about how sensitivity is constructed and understood, but also how we can transform what maybe has felt to us like that Achilles heel
totally
into a greater strength.
Yeah, and yeah. I feel like the premise of the podcast in and of itself is for us to, because both of us feel things very deeply. If you
yes.
listen to the podcast, we talk and we rage and we swear and we, you know, just express and explore a lot of what we're feeling inside, and then respond to things that are happening in the world as well. And that's because we're two sensitive people. And we just so happen to also, like, I'm an extrovert, so I feel like I guess after years of being told I'm sensitive and then also feeling like, you know, what I have to say wasn't as important in certain settings, it's like, growing up into this person where you're able to harness a sensitivity and then like speak on it. Because I think oftentimes in my experience, it's been like, you feel all these emotions As a sensitive person, you're like perceptive to what the energy that's changing in a room. Like when somebody says something that's really fucked up, you're like, wow, I don't know if I can respond to that. I'm just going to take that in and hold it inside of me and keep going. And sometimes I can, it feels like with all that sensitivity and all those things you're holding, like it's a big weight. And it can be, for lack of a better word, paralyzing. Like if you don't have a place or a conduit to channel that sensitivity, it can feel like you can do nothing with it. I don't know if that's ever been something that you've experienced, but
yeah, it's like a constant state of overwhelm, I think, if you're just holding everything within you.
Yeah.
And maybe that's similar to what I was talking about around like crying. When I was trying to hold it in, I would cry all the time. Mm-hmm. And then when I don't try to hold it in, I cry sometimes, but it doesn't feel like it's this sort of, I don't know, this like explosion, like waiting to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think maybe it's similar overall with sensitivity. It's like we need to be finding ways to release what we're holding. Otherwise, it just gets like heavier and heavier and heavier. And like the energy too. It's a lot of energy to be holding in your body.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I'm curious, like, because we are two queer, brown, black folks of color. Oftentimes when we're having conversations in this day and age, mm-hmm. talking about being progressive people, talking about, you know, trying to hold ourselves accountable, trying to hold institutions and people accountable for fuckery, which includes, I love that word, but that's like, you know, the just like heteronormativity and patriarchy and white supremacy and racism and all these kinds of things, what you end up getting back from the ether or the powers that be is that like y'all are so sensitive. Millennials are so sensitive. You guys don't know, like, you know, back in my day it was XYZ thing, and it's like you get that a lot from folks who have the privilege of not having to be sensitive. You know, it's like, yeah. And I think it's kind of, it's funny to me, and I'm saying funny because I don't know what else to say, but for as people who live at the intersections of a lot of different identities that are like marginalized, mm-hmm. we hold so much shit. Like we take the, you know, the sexist comments, we take the transphobic comments, we take all those things. And then when we have the power, the capacity to say, you know, fuck this, I don't like it, please stop it. Or further to that, like how you're not going to treat me is like this. Mm-hmm. People want to say that you're sensitive. And I think it's hilarious because the people who experience the most amount of hurt and hold on to all that hurt are like seen as weak or sensitive. Yeah. And it's like, can we flip that narrative? You know what I mean? Like perhaps it is the people who have been benefiting from white supremacy and patriarchy and capitalism and all those things that are the ones who are the ultra sensitive because they have never had anyone tell them to their face that what they're doing or saying or perpetuating is fucked up.
Well, yeah. And then you see, that's like the fragility response to you, right? That you see that as soon as somebody actually says something approaching the truth to some of these people, they have absolute meltdowns and they can't handle it. And it's like, I'm sorry, I thought I was the one who's so sensitive, right? But then you don't seem to be able to
hold your shit together. And it's even when you're having those conversations of like, hypothetically speaking, like white people can be racist, it's like, well, not all white people. And it's like, maybe in that moment, and I think we always talk about this, like, because I have family who's white, my partner is white, it's like recognizing maybe in that moment your natural response to be reactive, mm-hmm. is more indicative of something inside of you that feels shame about what I'm saying or feels like it resonates or it feels like you're talking to me. Totally. Or maybe that you feel like you need to speak up on behalf of your entire race, which I'm not asking you to do. You know what I'm saying? Like there's all these things that we can start to begin to process when we realize that when someone's sharing things on their heart and our response is to be more sensitive and then to call that other person sensitive, mm-hmm. it's like this constant like gaslighting cycle that really doesn't serve any purposes and no one's learning anything.
And it totally is gaslighting. And I think when I notice it a lot too, when people, the sort of insulting, like, oh, you're so triggered, and like the pejorative way that people talk about safe spaces and things like that.
Yes.
And as somebody who lives with complex PTSD, the idea that living with complex PTSD somehow makes me weak, it's like the pain tolerance that I've had to develop.
People wouldn't be able to, like, it's laughable.
It is. It honestly is. It's like, it's just, there's people who have had every advantage in the world and have had the entire world building them up and giving them strength and then seem to fall apart again at, like, the smallest little comment. And it's like, if I actually fell apart every time something triggered me.
You'd be just falling apart, pieces of Lego everywhere.
I wouldn't be sitting here right now. I wouldn't be functioning. I wouldn't be alive, right? Yeah. Because it's we live in such a hostile world for some of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, just take a deep breath.
Do you think that it's true? Because we always talk about, you know, you have to be able to tune into how you're feeling in your body and tune into yourself and recognize when the things that you're feeling are legitimate. Because I think for a lot of us, we just gaslight ourselves and say like, oh, I have this knot in my stomach. And somebody that's been really abusive is around me. Oh, who knows what that's about? Like, we just disassociate the two things. Yeah. So we talk about, you know, tuning into our bodies and knowing and recognizing when the manifestations of harm, of trauma, mm-hmm. are like felt in the body. I'm curious if you think that in order for us to be tuned into other people or to be sensitive to others, we have to be first tuned into ourselves. Because sometimes people will be like, you can't love other people unless you love yourself, RuPaul. right? But I'm curious from your perspective if you think that there's like a first step, second step, or if you it's possible for you to... Because I think there's a lot of folks who feel so deeply about other people and it, you know, is really upsetting for them to see horrific things around them, but they might not be so tied to their own situation or even know why they respond the way they do.
So, so I don't think you have to be tuned into yourself in order to be picking up energy from other people at all. I think a lot of people don't have control over it. The energy is just hitting them. I think, so I like to talk about the difference between, well, the specific thing that is accurate empathy,
right?
Because people talk about empathy as being able to sort of feel what other people are feeling.
Yeah.
But I think accurate empathy is very key because often we think we understand what other people are feeling, but we are not correct.
Like we're projecting?
Perhaps? Yeah, we're projecting, right. Or there's for some reason something's getting in the way. Like it might be the way that particular person expresses themselves. We're used to reading certain cues in a different way, like culturally.
Sure.
Things can be different, or just like personality-wise. Mm-hmm. So I think if we're not tuned in to ourselves, then it's much harder to actually have accurate empathy for other people because we don't know what we might be projecting or what might be skewed. So I've actually experienced some people in my life who think that they're deeply empathic, and I
would
do not
beg to differ
in that way at all.
Right.
But I think they're highly sensitive, so I think they're feeling the energy around them all the time. But that next step of being able to figure out, okay, what might you be feeling in this situation? Mm-hmm. That's a whole other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What do you think? How does that land?
That lands with me perfectly fine. I think that makes sense because you can have people who, you can definitely have folks who feel a lot of feelings, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, like, we always talk about there's a difference between a state and a feeling, you know, see ya, might not be for them, that's okay. There's a difference between a state of mind and a feeling, and, like, feelings are information, but they might not always be, like, and they're legitimate, but it doesn't mean they're always, like, accurately telling you a fact or whatever. And, like, you're talking about somebody who says it, like, self-selects, and, like, I'm an empath, but it's, like, your behavior would show otherwise. It sounds like you just, you know, you feel the stuff, but you don't know what to do with the stuff.
Yeah, and I think, actually, a lot of people who cause huge amounts of harm in the world are very highly sensitive, and it's the fact that they can't handle it that's so overwhelming for them. And like I think there are a lot of like people who are socialized as men, they're taught to often manage their feelings by controlling other people,
right?
Because they're not really allowed to have the full range of human.
That sounds like my dad. It's terrifyingly accurate.
A lot of people have that experience.
Yeah.
Because if you're not allowed to have the full range of human experience, human emotions,
right,
then you need to like shut it down if something is causing you to have that emotion. And so you control another person because you can't handle the feeling that it brings up for you. And
right.
It's not just people socialized as men. A lot of people do that, but
sure. Yeah.
Particularly.
I wrote this note down that's like, if you feel a lot and you're sensitive, you care a lot. Do you think that's true?
No. Well,
I love asking you these kinds of questions.
No, I don't think so. I don't know. I mean, maybe at some level, like there might've been a time where that was true,
sure.
But I think in practice, in practice, no. I think that there's a lot of people who maybe at some level, at some point in the past, they cared.
Yeah.
But they've layered so many layers of entitlement and selfishness and callousness.
Yeah.
Maybe to protect that really sensitive part. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think in practice,
it's more complicated than that.
What do you think?
No, I write these things down and then I think about it some more and I'm like, no, that doesn't even resonate very much.
Yeah.
Because it's like you could feel a lot of feelings. And like I said, they might not be legitimate. You might be like feeling a type of way because of something unrelated to, you know, this interaction, let's say.
Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that like the way that you respond to the thing that's bothered you is legitimate or fair or kind or worthy. And that doesn't mean, and that's what showing care is. Like
yeah.
care means that you have a, you feel like you have a stake in this and you want to support this person or this situation or whatever. So I would agree.
So what do you think the ingredients are then? Because a lot of people can be sensitive, but then there's some people who use their sensitivity in order to be caring people, to do good for other people, mm-hmm. to show up in their relationships or in the world in a way that maximizes benefit, minimizes harm, like we always talk about.
Yeah.
So what do you think the ingredients beyond sensitivity are to becoming that person who's maximizing benefit and minimizing harm in the world?
I think an ingredient that is not included is ego.
Yeah.
Like we all come to it, we come with our egos, but I think you can have a person who's really caring and who does a lot for other folks and is lovely and all these things. But I think that fundamentally, if the reason that that person is doing things is to satiate their own ego or to make themselves feel good about something, inevitably there's a breakdown because that person sees their identity so tied to this sort of transaction. I don't know if, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I think you have to be able to do things that are inherently good for the inherent good of it. Not because of some
right.
other reason that is tied
status
to your identity status, that the person will owe you, that the person will like you. Because like people always say ego, like, you know, you're a narcissist, but it could be just, you know, you're trying to have your needs met too. And that's mm-hmm. totally fair. But I think that there's a fine line there.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think responsibility is maybe mm-hmm. one, like having a real sense of the collective and that it's not just about me, that
yeah.
it's about everybody.
Yeah.
So I think that maybe is a big ingredient, and emotional regulation, like skill
yes.
in being able to handle the sensitivity, because otherwise you go into a state of overwhelm. And like we always talk about, if you're in a state of overwhelm, you don't always even have that much conscious control
over how you're
your
responding.
Doing.
Totally.
Yeah,
yeah, you're being reactive though.
Yeah,
right?
You're in like fight or flight mode.
Yes.
And so you start maybe screaming at somebody, and maybe that's not how your highest, best self wants to react. But if you're not doing the emotional work to expand your ability to handle what's happening without going into that state of overwhelm,
mm-hmm.
then yeah.
It's not really helpful to other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know when we were planning this episode, we wanted to talk about sensitivity as a form of leadership, or what you can do, like how do sensitive people actually like live their lives? Because people will often, like, it is true. We don't just like all sit in a box like crying and sad. Some of us do
sometimes.
We need to do those things. But like there are people who are sensitive that walk among you, like we were saying earlier, and then they're your friends or your family. It might be you. I'm wondering whether or how you see emotional intelligence being an important part of leadership.
Oh my God, it's so important. I mean, like, how many jobs have we all quit or like gone on stress leave from because the person who's running the organization has no emotional intelligence?
Mm-hmm.
I worked somewhere that was supposedly a feminist anti-oppressive organization where not only was like discrimination and pay inequity rampant, the person running it, who's a woman, yelled at another person, and then when she started crying, she told her she was a bad feminist for crying.
Sorry.
Yeah. This
yeah.
is real.
You can't make
right?
this shit up. Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is the kind of thing
yeah.
that happens when people with low emotional intelligence are running things.
Yeah.
So I think we can actually run healthy workplaces, or dare I dream of a world where people were running things not based on greed, power, ego,
yes,
status, right, wealth,
yes,
but based on sensitivity to the common good.
Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, a person who has emotional intelligence and is like able to be, accurate empathy, is a person who takes the things that they're feeling, tests their assumptions, and then when they find out new information, like takes steps and actions to make sure that people around them are okay. Like that's, yeah, that's the step process that I'm thinking of. It's like, you can see something and then you can say nothing. You can see something and then you can say something. Yeah. You can see something and then you can do something different about it. You know, it's like, so after you're witnessing, like if you're in a position of leadership or even in your own like interpersonal relationships, I think it's recognizing when the things that we're feeling are true, real, and have a meaning and a place. Mm-hmm. And sometimes then it's just speaking on them or acting on them. Mm-hmm. Because I was saying before, oftentimes the things we feel inside of us, the responses, the reactions to harmful things around us, we can suppress and ignore. Yeah. But it's like, okay, how do we use the things that we feel so deeply for, like, transformation?
Yeah, you know? And I think so much of it is recognizing those things as being a key source of information, because I think when we look at the world that we're currently living in, I think we're seeing the results of cultures that believe that logic and, you know, devoid of emotion, just like supposed objective facts and things like that, are the only ways of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think if, you know, going way, way, way back, if we were honoring what we feel as being just as valid in terms of sources of, you know, information and knowledge,
yeah,
I don't think we could have done what we've done in terms of like the horrific ways that we've trashed the earth and committed so many genocides and, you know, all of these things, because those things are inherently wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that any healthy human being can feel that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's taken generations and generations and generations of people suppressing what they feel,
yeah,
in order to get where we are now.
Absolutely. And I think when you were just talking about how certain things aren't seen, how we feel isn't seen as like fact or true,
mm-hmm,
and that's how the world has worked for so far, so long.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I think we can't have conversations about things that are about our own identities, because they're lived experiences. Mm-hmm. How else do you describe like racism other than I felt like that was,
yeah,
racist? And if somebody's response is, well, you're being biased, well, you know, you don't know, I'm not racist, but da 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 da, all these kinds of things, like we're not actually able to hold space for somebody else's feelings ever, like at the interpersonal level, as like people in the same community, as Canadians, like even this past election, talking about Trudeau and blackface, and then Peter Mansbridge talking about Canadians are over that. They don't want to talk about it. And it's like, which Canadians? Because I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
I would like to keep talking about how our prime minister right now is a person who wore blackface or brownface, not once, not twice, but like multiple times, and probably more than.
And while he was a teacher at a,
like,
school, I think that's under discussed. Like, how do you think the students felt?
Yes, exactly. And
going to that school,
I think more like just like, for me, I find the conversation of sensitivity and being able to hold space and being able to have those tough conversations to be really, the labor is always on the people who are experiencing the most like fuckery to,
yeah,
voice it. And then we get shut down and we get shut down and we get shut down.
Yeah.
So it would be so amazing, dare I imagine, for us to be living in a world where the folks who have systemic power and privilege are able to hold space for us to be able to express the things like we do on this podcast without any, we don't asking anyone's permission, but we also welcome the fact that we might not say things that resonate with people who are really holding fast to their privilege and don't want to actually examine the ways that they've been harmful or been insensitive in a really massive way.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Totally. And this, I've been thinking, so I heard somebody, I can't remember where, but somebody was talking about how, you know how in a lot of fairy tales there is like the witch who is like living in the woods and,
yes,
it's like isolated,
yeah,
whatever. So I heard someone saying that where that actually comes from is that healers and people doing like magical kinds of works need to live more in isolation and have a lot more like quiet self-reflection time. And it resonated with me so much that when you're somebody who feels so much and takes in so much information from everywhere, especially if you want to then work with people and change something in the world, you really, really need sacred spaces where you can clear yourself of all of those things that you're taking in and holding. And that's such a key part of survival, and it's like a key part of being able to work the magic that you might be able to work with all of that sensitivity.
Like a time alone, time away,
time to clear and time to reflect.
I feel like sensitivity, in my opinion, it means we're awake, we're alive, we are engaged, we're tuned in. Like, that's, I think sensitivity can feel, like I said, paralyzing and passive, but it also means, like, now we have an obligation. We feel so many things. And I think I'm just, like, really excited for this, what feels like a wave of folks who are creating things and having conversations from a really sensitive place. Because we are taking up spaces and having our voices heard. And we're people who, like, I'm a pretty, like, loud, like, outgoing person, but sometimes you can just be so caught up in, like, the things that are happening internally that you think it doesn't actually matter. But I think it's fantastic that we're in spaces now where folks are actually taking the things that they feel, the sensitive stuff, and putting it out there for folks to push back on or have conversations about.
And I think, because I think this is the thing, it's been made to feel, we've been made to feel like sensitivity is a flaw and a weakness, but it's also a superpower, and especially if we have the support to allow us to, you know, live in this overwhelming world and still be well and be who we are. And I think seeing other people share their sensitivity and do such incredible things with it, it helps us imagine what's possible.
That's a really good segue into our Woman of Color of the Week.
So our Woman of Color of the Week is Octavia Butler. And apologies to anyone who knows me in this audience, because you've probably heard me talk about this many, many times. So Octavia Butler was a Black science fiction writer and a recipient of the MacArthur Genius Grant. She wrote a lot of amazing novels and short stories. Some of my favorites are Wild Seed, Kindred, and the Parable novels. And that's what I want to talk about today. I was actually introduced to these books through a Talib Kweli lyric. Do you know the song Miss Hill?
No.
Oh, really? We need to listen to this. He wrote it for Lauryn Hill, and he talks about this book in a lyric in it. Anyways, so back in the 90s, Octavia wrote The Parable of the Sower and The Parable of the Talents. So those are two speculative fiction novels. They're set starting in the 2020s.
I know,
it's very close to home. And especially if you read it. So she imagined a world very much like the one we're starting to anticipate now, where societies begun to collapse because of climate change and wealth inequality and corporate greed. In the second book, there's actually a fascist president who came to power on a platform promising to make America great again.
You know that Donald Trump did not read that book, so, like...
So she actually, she wrote two. She meant she planned to write a bunch more, but she found it too depressing, so she stopped after the second one, which... Now we're living it. Anyways, so the reason I wanted to highlight this work as we're talking about sensitivity is that in this apocalyptic setting, the person Octavia chose as a protagonist was a young Black woman named Lauryn, who had something that Octavia had imagined as hyper-empathy syndrome. So as the name suggests, it was this extreme form of sensitivity to the point where Lauryn could see someone else in pain. If she could see it, she felt it as if it was happening to her. So it was absolutely debilitating, because like if she saw someone else badly injured, then she'd be completely incapacitated. So despite its liabilities, though, I think that the extreme sensitivity was what brought Lauryn outside of her experience in the books and made her this leader in these dystopian times. So her condition forced her to be extremely intentional and judicious, because if she used force against someone else, she'd experience the pain as well. So if she punched someone in the face, it's like punching herself in the face as well. But sometimes she still had to do that in order to survive. And I think that the sensitivity, too, it allowed her to develop this belief system that could carry herself and other survivors through the apocalypse. And that belief system has actually inspired real-life activists like Adrienne Marie Brown, whose book Emergent Strategy is based on this belief system that Octavia created through Lauren in these books. So that included principles like everything you touch, you change. Everything you change, changes you. The only real truth is change. Mm. She also says, partnership is giving, taking, learning, teaching, offering the greatest possible benefit while doing the least possible harm. Very on brand for us. Yes. That's one of our themes. Yes. Partnership is mutualistic symbiosis. Partnership is life. Any entity, any process that cannot or should not be resisted or avoided must somehow be partnered. So this is asking us to show up with full presence, to use our sensitivity, to notice every way we're affected by everything that surrounds us and how it impacts, how we're impacting all of that in return. So the depths of our sensitivity brings us to new heights of responsibility and power, and we're using the information we can glean from our immediate surroundings to maximize the benefit and minimize the harm that we bring to our entire interconnected universe.
I love that. The depths, say that again, the depths of our...
The depths of our sensitivity can bring us to new heights of responsibility and power.
Yeah. So feel the feelings and then do something.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, that's... I need to read these books.
You do.
You know that I don't, like, I start a bunch of books and I don't finish them, though.
I know. You have many of my books, but it's okay because I do the same thing. It's better that way, honestly, because I have like 20 books in my place that I've like, I'm like a third of the way through. So, but if you read the first one, I have a hard copy of the second one to give to you.
Oh, do you have the first, do you have the first one?
No.
Ugh, okay. All right, well.
Oh. Yeah, I actually got it from the library the first time I read
you.
It. So, public services. So we're really curious if anyone here has anything to comment, any questions, any thoughts, reflections.
Debbie. I'm going to repeat the question because I don't know if that was picked up.
Yeah.
Ah, learning. So you're asking whether, when someone tells us that we're sensitive, what is the process of processing? And then what's your response?
Like, almost how do you feel immediately, and then how do you process it and turn it into something positive that you can use to...
Right. I'll try. Yeah,
question.
That's a great question. I don't think people don't tell me I'm sensitive to my face anymore. I think I have shed that skin because people know me to be a more outspoken person. But I think it's the way that people respond to things that I say, because the things that I'll say make it sound like I care about people, and that might rub somebody the wrong way if they don't really share that same sentiment. But it's true.
Yeah.
I think for myself, I've just tried to hold true to my values and know what those things are, and that's in my arsenal of things that give me like strength and support. Because otherwise, I'm trying to, I don't know, find my reflection or find solace in somebody else's eyes, and they don't see the things the way that I see things. So just trusting that the things that I think are important, or my sensitivities, or the triggers that I might have, or the times where I might say, hey, when you say this word, this is what it means, and like putting myself out there, trusting that that's my responsibility because of the values that I hold, which is speaking truth to power, which is, you know, holding marginalized folks at the helm of my own personal activism. And then I think from that place, it's a lot easier to let go of what people... I don't need to respond to somebody's like, oh, you're so soft. I'll be like, yeah, cool. You know, it doesn't hurt me in the same way, because I actually don't give that person that weight in my, or that ability to affect my politics, or my, you know, it's somebody's response to me being like, yo, that's really racist. And if they are losing their shit, I'm just like, well, you're proving my point. See ya. Keep it moving. That's me. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, hilariously, now that I've embraced my sensitivity, I feel like I more often almost get people saying the opposite, like saying that I'm, too callous or something because I will just speak
say
truth of power, essentially, right? Yeah. And so it's like, oh, you're so rude and
brazen whatever.
And
sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay. That's, sure.
Yeah. Not your cup of tea. That's fine.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Hi, Jane.
Thank you. That's an amazing question. So I'll say it into the mic. So you're talking about how some people, like counselors and writers and the more sensitive people, have such a disproportionate share of the burden of caring for everybody, figuring everything out. And so how do we make sure that the healers and the poets and everybody are cared for? Is that inaccurate? Yes, thank you. Yeah, I think I'm thinking of something from, I think it was on In Bed with Betty, Anita Chung's, one of her businesses, where she talks about kindness as being one of their values. And then she says, this doesn't mean that we let people walk all over us because kindness starts at home. And so we have our own boundaries. And I think that really speaks to me that we have to know our limits and know when we need to stop and take a step back and care for ourselves. I think it's also about picking our battles too, because to me, I find it much more burdensome or much more draining to try to solve other people's problems or try to care for people who hate me and don't want me to exist. But when I focus my care work on people who are in my communities, who also are capable of being in deep relationship with me as well, then it feels like there is a mutuality to it that I think, can lead to being cared for as well as caring.
Mm. Yeah, I think I love what you just said. I struggle because it doesn't. It's hard to put the onus on people who don't care, you know, to be like, hey, care about people who care to people who don't care. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
How do you change hearts and minds is basically the bigger question. And I think it comes, like, changing hearts and minds, so far it's been a lot of people who are marginalized trying to change the hearts and minds. So now I think it's people with a lot of privilege whose hearts and minds have been changed to change other people's hearts and minds, you know? Like, that's the work. I think that's where it's got to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because the healers and the folks, like, that are doing the heavy lifting can only take so much of that burden to do the work for themselves and to try to do the work and try to let people know. But, like, I always say, like, when you know better, you have to do better.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, like, take it and run with it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
I also think so much of this is about building community, because
yeah.
it can be so easy to be working in isolation, and it can be so hard to ask for help and be vulnerable when we're struggling. And there's so much shame still attached to struggling or to needing care or to needing to ask for help. So I think that it's so important for us to come out from, you know, our isolated spaces that sometimes we need those, but I think we also need to be really building groups and putting the most marginalized as the at the center, like Leah Lakshmi Pyavsna Samarasena. Her work is so much about, you know, disabled people's needs are not an afterthought. We need to be putting that at the center. And how would all of our communities and all of our lives be transformed if that was the starting point instead of an afterthought?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keaton.
So just like thank you first of all, like I would like I know I listen to first of all, like whether what you're saying is like it obviously resonates. But my question is more so looking at like my perspective comes from like my family's perspective, is indigenous and a lot of my family like went to like our Zoom schools and then like, some of private sort of thing, and that's kind of transcended into the way we show our feelings or the ability to.
Thank you. Do you want
to? I can summarize what you said into the microphone. Is that okay? So, Keaton, you're speaking from a experience of being Indigenous and having family members who survived residential schools, and you're noticing sensitivity in yourself and trying to create space for your family members who you feel are sensitive people but don't feel like they can express that sensitivity. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. Love you. My mom is very sensitive. She's a very sensitive person. My sister's laughing because it's true. She's a very sensitive person, but I think she was raised in, she's Kenyan, and so it's, like, very British colonial, like, you don't cry, all those kinds of things. She, like, allowed us and afforded us a lot of space as kids. She indulged our feelings a lot, but for herself, she's, like, a stoic, I'm the mom, I shouldn't be crying, I shouldn't be, you know, that's a lot of, the repression is the thing that is her stick. And so I've noticed in my relationship with her, the way that I, because I'm just trying to, like, build a new relationship as an adult with my mom, and that's so different than when you're a kid, because you get stuck in certain identities and roles and all those kinds of things. You're trying to break those molds and create new ways of relating to somebody that you want to know as a person, not just as your mom, because she's fully a whole person outside of being your mom, right? So for me, it's been just sharing, like calling my mom and literally oversharing to my mom, like telling her things, asking her, like, how does it make you feel? What do you think? Like, even if it's, like, the gossipy things, because I know that she has a lot to say, but I don't know if she's ever been asked, like, how does that make you feel? I want to know how you feel. What you have to say is important. Your feelings are important to me. I don't, you know what I mean? Like, that's been something that's helped us have more, like, more honest conversations about how she's actually doing or things that she's going through, that sort of thing. I don't know if that's helpful, but
I think that's huge. I think that being vulnerable creates space for other people to be vulnerable, for sure. And I think also another way of creating space too is giving a lot of empathy, and often it gets fully rejected if people aren't willing to go there, where you're like, that sounds really painful. They're like, I don't know, whatever. And it can be a little hard, but I find if you keep trying over time, or maybe I like to think that maybe it gets in there somewhere, even if they're not really accepting it. But I definitely think that creating spaces where we are vulnerable, I think, is the biggest thing that we can really do to normalize that. And it can take time. I've had people, like when I was in undergrad, my best friend and I talked a lot about our experiences of surviving sexual violence, and we'll still have, like, 10 years later, somebody that we knew at the time message us and say, hey, when you talked about that, that has really helped me to come to terms with my own experiences. So sometimes you don't even, it doesn't look like you're having an impact, but I really think it does create an opening for new possibilities for other people. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Oh, we were texting for a while, bouncing off ideas, and I think we had just, we have like a chain of thought where we just like say stuff and whatever sticks. Did I say, I was like, I just said scene, period, that's it, or something like that, that's the name. And like instantly Lala was like, I love it. Like it was kind of, it just felt... Because we had our graphic before we had... Did we have our graphic first?
So.
No, we had the name first. Yeah, yeah.
But our whole concept, it was like seeing the world through our eyes, as black and brown queer women, and then also us seeing each other in all of our freedom and uncensored truth.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it was sort of... Yeah, we were looking for something along those lines. So something about seeing and being seen.
Yeah. And it's also really great because on Instagram, when people send us messages, it'll be like, scene. So we're always on brand all the time. Even when we don't, it's really great.
The eye roll we just got from y'all. We have time for like one more question, if anyone has one, or... Yeah, so I'll summarize it on the mic. So thank you so much for that question and for sharing. So it was this idea that sometimes when, for some people with PTSD, you might not feel things, and that can feel like a superpower because you can take everything. And then when you start healing, suddenly you feel everything, and it feels like such a weakness. It feels like you can't do the things that you used to do, and you're losing all this time. And so how do we reframe that into actually being a strength or a superpower? And I think for one thing, it changes day to day because there are days where I feel like, because of the lifetime of trauma and the many years spent in the healing process that will continue forever, I feel like I can connect so deeply to other people. And, you know, as a therapist, I can hold space for other people. And I value so much, I think so much of, I mean, my entire career and so much of what I do in the world and so much what I value is my ability to take in so much information and be able to see things from so many different sides. And be able to have not just my intellect, but also my intuition and my feelings. So I feel so powerful. And then there's times where, like, you know, recently had an extreme major flare-up of PTSD, and it impacted my ability to work. I cry like all day every day. I couldn't eat, you know, all of these kinds of things. And so it isn't always a superpower, because yeah, so often the world is so hard to live in. And I think that's just true. So yeah, I think maybe it's about being able to just be with what is and feel the moments where you know that you could not feel the joy and gratitude that you feel with every ounce of your being so deeply if you didn't have all of this. Mm. And then the times where it's way too much and it hurts so much, being able to just be angry or be sad or numb or whatever it is you need to do to get through that. And it's all part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not saying anything more. That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for being here for our first live episode. Yeah, it's so amazing to see all of you and to have you all hold the space for us. So thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Hey everyone, it's Nick.
And Lala.
If you've been listening to Scene and you like what you hear,
please share us with your friends.
Subscribe to the podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at Scene the Podcast.
Write a review and just tell us what you think.
And help make this work sustainable by supporting Scene the Podcast on Patreon.
We need our beautiful community and we cannot do this without you.